The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, welcome everyone to our Monday evening talk here at IMC. And I'm very happy if anybody who's joining us now or maybe listening to this, watching this in the future. Welcome. And so we are now well into a new world. This is March 16th, 2020. And a big part of the globe is now challenged with the spread of the COVID-19 virus. And here in the counties and the areas where I live here in San Francisco Bay Area, we just had a announcement, or just was proclaimed, in the form of a new, I guess, temporary law order that we should be take shelter in our homes and no longer leave our homes except to go to shopping to for food or medicine or and take care of the essentials of our life, but otherwise to be homebound, and with also the exception of maybe going to an open space like a park where you can do some exercise. And so it's a radical curtailing of life as usual. And it is also, many people now are not going to work. Many of the children are, most here in this area, the schools are closed. Many of the businesses have either closed or, if they could, send people home to work from home. Quite a few people are now out of work and wondering about how they're going to make their rent and be able to pay for food for their family without a steady income coming in because they're out of work. And some places of work have sent people home and continue to pay their salary, regardless of whether they're working at home or not, just that this is a time that they feel that everyone has to band together and support each other and do what we can to stretch and make this work for our, you know, our friends, our colleagues, our employees, our neighbors, and really kind of make this whole thing work. And in a sense, for these places in the world, and Italy and Spain and China and other places, where they've taken such radical restrictions in movement and people have to stay at home, that it's a remarkable movement or expression of how many people have to work together to create the welfare for everyone. That without everyone cooperating, that many people will die, many people will get sick. But even though we're not directly affected ourselves, maybe, that we're all sharing in the protection of curtailing the spread of it and curtailing our lives dramatically. So it's a new world that we live in. And I'm aware that some people are quite anxious, some people are confused and distressed, some people are quite sad at the distance they have, the lack of direct contact with maybe some family or friends and colleagues, neighbors even, and maybe feel isolated at home. And some people are seeing this as an opportunity, seeing this. Some people, I'm sure, are quite happy with the idea of being home. It just coincidence, I was starting to teach a retreat yesterday at our retreat center. It was supposed to be a residential retreat with about 50 people. And so that was canceled because we can't come together and be together and in that kind of setting in this new environment. But we transferred it into being an online retreat. And now there's about 70 people doing the online retreat. And most of the people, very local in this Bay Area, most of them, you know, very much affected by this new ordinance that we have to be sheltered, is the word, sheltered at home. And that's exactly what they started doing yesterday, taking refuge in their homes to be their meditation center, to dedicate this week to the best that's possible with the kind of home life they have, whatever situation they have, to focus on meditation practice and Dharma practice and Dharma teachings. And it's remarkable for them, you know, in a sense, they went into retreat yesterday, and now all their neighbors everywhere are doing the same. And but not exactly a meditation retreat, but the government calls it being sheltered. We call it being on retreat. And they call it, the government people in the wider world call it isolation. And in the Buddhist language, we call it seclusion. Seclusion is almost like a metaphor in the ancient tradition of Buddhism for meditation, really being kind of alone, kind of dedicated, you know, not involved with the ordinary activities of daily life, and spending that time engaged in spiritual practice. And so there's a wide range of challenges that people have. And now, these Dharma talks that I give on Monday nights are meant to be Dharma talks. And so the question is that, what is the Dharma? How does this relate to this new era, to what people are struggling with, challenged with? What are the opportunities in these challenges? What are the ways to practice with it? What's the orientation we can have that somehow is supported by Dharma teachings? And as I reflect on this, I think of the what's called the three trainings, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, usually translated into English as ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And these are the three trainings, they're called. It's a set of practices that we're training ourselves, we're developing and cultivating ourselves, that we're growing in when we're involved in Dharma practice. And these are kind of the activities of the Dharma practice. There's the activity of taking care of our ethics and living an ethical life. There's the activity of meditation and cultivating, developing our inner life. And there's the activity of cultivating, developing wisdom. This is our understanding life, how we understand our life. And so these are activities that we can intentionally engage in. These are the basic Dharma activities in which we enter the world with and try to understand how to live our life. And so here, these three trainings are just as relevant now as any other time, or maybe more so. And we can reflect on what are these three trainings look like now in this COVID-19 era. And how do we? And so, for Buddhists, this is directly connected to how do we engage in Buddhist practice for the benefit of ourselves and others at this time? What does that practice look like, and how do we use this period to grow and develop? So, it's also an expression of the confidence and the sense of purpose that comes with Dharma practice, that we're not at sea and being pushed around by the currents of life and going willy-nilly here or there, or being swept over by the tides or the tidal waves of what goes on in our life, but rather we look to see how we can meet whatever the circumstances are, no matter how difficult and how wonderful, as places to do these three trainings. So the first one, being ethics, has a lot to do with two things. That's mostly what they have to do with. They have to do with not causing harm on one hand, and the other hand, to bring benefit to being support the welfare of others, to do good. And so on the side of not causing harm, how do we live our life now in a way that doesn't contribute to harm to anyone whatsoever? And the thing that stands out for me is right now is here, I don't know what's happening so much in terms of hoarding in other parts of the world, but here in the United States, there are some places where people now are making, rushing to the supermarkets and emptying the shelves. And I've been through some of these supermarkets and remarkably seen, row after row of empty shelves that, before in this wealthy country that we have, it was remarkable the cornucopia of choices and abundance of goods that were for sale in these huge supermarkets. And to see them empty is quite something. One of the things I went to buy, look for, was a certain kind of over-the-counter medicine, and that was completely gone. The thing about, and certainly we were asked to stay now indoors and stay sheltered for the next 3 weeks here in the Bay Area. And so it'd be ideal if we had bought and had enough food for those 3 weeks so we didn't have to go out. In some ways, that would be fine. But there are people who are buying things, enough supplies to last a year. And when people buy some supplies, there are necessities for others. For example, if you don't need certain over-the-counter medication, but you buy a year's supply, then there are people who come along who do need it. It's not available. And so there's this, when there's hoarding way beyond what's needed, a way of protecting ourselves for a long time, and enough people do this, then the vulnerable in our society, the people who can't get to the supermarket, to the markets, to the stores, maybe who don't have the money to buy huge stockpiles of food, they're left scrambling unnecessarily. Because, these essential supplies in this country of ours are not going to run out that easily. But they will run out in the short term for people. So in terms of not causing harm, to think a little bit about how are we behaving? What are we shopping? What are we doing? And if we then don't just think about ourselves, but think of it in the aggregate of many other people who are doing the same as we are. And do we just succumb to the herd mentality, just do it like everybody else? Or we try in small ways to try to mitigate some of the unnecessary harmful side effects of how people behave in this time and place. But then there's lots of people who are thinking about what can I do that's good. There are neighbors now who are thinking about can I go shopping for you? I'm in the store. Can I get something for you? Or we can share now as we go along, and if we need things, and so the idea that we're also here to support each other, and how do we help each other? When I went to the market on Saturday, I was struck by there was much more a kind of a mutual care in the supermarket aisles. I had the feeling that people were more caring, more friendly, they were more supportive. That in that environment, I didn't feel like they were hoarding or greeting. I felt that they were acquiring things, but what they needed. But I also felt that it wasn't like there was a sense of competition or a sense of you get it more than something else. My wife went to the market today, and she thought, she saw someone with a big basket full of squash. And said, squash is a good idea. That'll keep for a long time. She went to the squash counter, and there was no squash there. Coincidentally, she was standing next to the woman, and they had a conversation. And my wife said, "Well, when I went to the squash, there was none there," and the woman gave her a squash happily. So these are small little steps. But do we want to live in a world where we're making it harder for people, or we want to make a world where we're supporting people and generous with people? This has to do with ethics. And ethics as a training, as a practice, is not about doing the moral thing necessarily. It's not about some external you know, more about, not so much about an external rules that we have to follow to be a good person. If that's the reason to do the ethical training in Buddhism, it actually doesn't train the heart. The sila, the ethical training in Buddhism, for yourself, is supposed to train your heart, cultivate your heart, develop your goodness of your heart, expand your heart and make it bigger, nourish your heart, make your inner life, as you look inside of yourself, you see these beautiful qualities of being that you're happy to have, that you're inspired to have, that that you feel delighted to have, that are what the Buddha called a form of wealth, that's the wealth to have. That's what we want to acquire and develop. Qualities like generosity, like being harmless, being compassionate, being caring, being, supportive of other people, making room for people. And so, if a person wants to be engaged in Buddhist training and the Dharma and how this applies, they'll be thinking about this, thinking about the ethics of it, thinking about how to they might be able to reduce the amount of harm they cause, or what they can do to bring benefit to others. It's a beautiful reflection, and may it be so, and may all of us support others. The training in meditation is also a training in developing these inner qualities that we have, inner capacities we have, but it's more directly involved with that rather than indirectly. And sitting down in meditation, doing inner practices that cultivate the heart, cultivate the mind, so that the inner life becomes beautiful. The inner life becomes also inspiring. That the inner life is a place you go inside, reach deep inside of yourself, really touch into what's deep inside and who you are on the inside. And what you find in there makes you happy, that makes your heart sing, this is good. It's not an easy thing to come to. For not a few people, many people, certainly it was for me, that to dip inside and reach deep inside and start seeing what's there, it can be quite difficult. There can be anger and grief, and sadness and fear, terror. There can be distress and feelings of shame, and you know, all kinds of things are housed inside. These are not problems for the purposes of Buddhist meditation. They are the food or the fuel or the basis that we're practicing with. We're trying to meet these things with the best qualities of heart that we can evoke. We're trying to meet the challenges in our hearts with kindness, with compassion, trying to meet the challenge that we have without shaming or belittling ourselves for having it, but to hold it with mindfulness, to be mindful of it, not critical of it. And the image I have for what mindfulness is for the difficult material in our hearts, in our side, is that of cupping our hands together and holding our difficulty, holding our fear, holding our shame, just gently holding it in cupped hands, soft hands, gently, just to offer support, like to hold it, and just to hold it and be with it, not to make it go away, not to fix it, not to condemn it, but just simply to let it be seen and held in this supportive embrace of awareness. And it's remarkable what that does. Things begin to thaw, things begin to open, things begin to kind of come alive or unfold or resolve, simply because they're seen and held and respected in a good way. And so we're developing our mindfulness as we meet these difficulties. We're developing our capacity, our courage to be present for what's difficult. We're developing our capacity for focus and concentration and staying present, not drifting off in thought. We're developing our capacity to let go. So when thoughts, distractions, unhealthy reflections and ideas and fantasies come along, that we're not trapped by them or caught by them, but we know how to recognize them, we know how to let go of them, we know how to come back. And slowly over time, we're cultivating and developing an inner life. So our inner life becomes healed, becomes whole, becomes settled, becomes a place that it's good to abide in. It can become our home, from which we then look at the world with different eyes. And looking at the world with different eyes is the domain of the third training, in wisdom. Wisdom is to come to a new understanding of this life of ours, to see it in ways that maybe we didn't understand it growing up, or the ways that, you know, somehow we acquired in the process of the life so far. It's to see a life to see our life, to understand our life from the perspective of one that's not selfish, that's not self-absorbed, that's not limited, contracted by self-preoccupation. When we're mindful of selfing, self-preoccupation, self being self-absorbed, self-concerned, there's nothing to be ashamed about. It's something too that can be held, seen, to be mindful of. But as we really feel and feel into and sense and are present for this self-involvement, self-attachment that is so common in human life, that we'll start seeing the limitations of it. We'll start seeing the pain of it, the stress of it. And if we really hold it kindly, it'll begin to dissolve, begin to soften. And we start seeing that there's much more, there's a different perspective on our life. There's this different way of seeing the world and seeing this psychophysical being that we are, that's freed of self-preoccupations, freed of self-entanglement and self-absorption. And it's a remarkable thing to relax and open up and have the forces of fear or greed or conceit begin that kind of reinforce and strengthen this brittle sense of self, to begin to soften and dissolve. We can just as well take care of ourselves without the self-absorption. Actually, we can take care of ourselves better the less self-absorbed and self-contracted we are. And to start seeing the world in a new way is this way is a part of the wisdom teachings of Buddhism. The other thing is to see, is to begin understanding how suffering arises in us, to begin really understanding the operating system of suffering, or understand the elements, the ecology of our suffering. In particular, to understand the nature of clinging, of craving, of attachment, and how those work in our minds and our hearts and our bodies, that how they contribute to suffering. It's kind of a truism in Buddhism that if you crave, you will suffer. That you can't get away from it if you're craving. Partly because craving itself, this craving being this compulsive desire that has us by the nose or by the throat, this compulsive desire that where there's contraction and force and pressure, where we can't just let go of it. It kind of has us rather than we have it. We can have desire, but craving is this powerful desire that has us in a sense. And we end up doing things that later we regret, or when we have wisdom, we realize that wasn't a wise thing to do. And craving can be subtle, while it still can be powerful. And so part of the wisdom aspect of Buddhism is to develop the insights, ability to see clearly what is going on in the ecology of suffering. Can we notice and see craving? Can we notice and see clinging as it occurs? Not to condemn it, not to feel shame for being that way. Of course we have it, we're human, and unless people practice, it's very hard to become free of it. But it is possible to become free. And the beginning of that is to have a new understanding, a new perspective, one that sees that there's also non-clinging. There's also the mind, the heart's capacity for non-craving. And the two, in a sense, can live side by side inside of us. If we really know how to connect and feel and see and be mindful of craving, then we can start looking beyond the edges of it, looking underneath it or above it, and see that it's not the whole show. There's more that, we're much more than the craving. There's much more here than the contracted forms of clinging and what we're attached to and want. And to be able to open up the field of awareness to see that there are other things happening here. There's the whole body and the heart, the emotions, the space, the mindfulness. And just the mindfulness itself. If you can be clearly mindful of clinging, then we are not defined by the clinging. Then we can say we have clinging, but we are not the clinging. When the clinging is strong, the craving is really strong and compulsive, and it has taken over in a sense, then in a sense we are clinging. It kind of defines us, if that's the where we rest in and where we're centered. But if we're no longer centered in it, and we find another center, a center of non-clinging, non-craving, which is the nature of mindfulness. It's right there in the mindfulness, in the kind of awareness practice of mindfulness. That it doesn't have any clinging or craving in it when mindfulness is clear. And to be able to separate these two out so that on one hand we can see the cravings we have, on the other hand we really are mindful of it. It's a little bit like being in the middle of a group of people, maybe who are standing around having a big argument about something and everyone's yelling and screaming and talking at once. And then we're part of all that, but at some point it occurs to us to step 4, 5, 10 feet away and look back at them. And we see that they're still arguing, but we are not. And it's clear that we're not in the argument, we're just observing it. So the same thing with mindfulness. We can and kind of metaphorically step back from what we're caught up and entangled with, to the point where we can, oh, I see it now. That's what's happening. I'm afraid, I'm preoccupied, I'm worried, I'm fantasizing, I'm thinking about imaginary futures and entangled in what might come and what might happen. And that's what's happening. And in that stepping back and saying, oh, that's what's happening, that begins a new perspective. That's an understanding. That belongs to the wisdom side of the training, to see clearly what's happening. As we see clearly clinging, we see the relationship between clinging and our suffering. We start seeing that the absence of clinging is the absence of suffering. So, three trainings. There's a training in what we do. It's the training in how we are, and the training in how we see, what we understand. And so when we live in times of challenges, if we want to bring our Buddhist practice to bear on the circumstances of whatever our challenges are, that we can ask ourselves three questions. What is it that I can do at this time that avoids causing harm and brings benefit to myself and others? What can I do in this time of challenge? How can I be? How can I focus on developing inside of me that cultivate good qualities, that develop the heart, develop the mind, bring forth what's best in me rather than have me succumb to what's not the best? And then for wisdom, how could I step back and see this in a new perspective? How can I have the mindfulness and the steady attention so that I'm not pulled into the argument, not swept up and caught up in the experience, but really step back or get the broader view or see clearly so that I have a perspective that it's freeing, a perspective that I find some ease and peace with what's going on rather than in being agitated and preoccupied and feel uneasy with it all. To really bring the Dharma to our challenges like this often takes a lot of dedication. It takes courage. It takes a real conviction that this is worthwhile to do. If there's a lot of people around us who feel the opposite or feel anxious and upset and angry, sometimes they expect you to share that with us. And there's a strong kind of sense of needing to conform sometimes to how other people are feeling and what's going on. And they might even feel disturbed if we're not like them and if we're discovering how to be calm and centered and try to see the situation from a different perspective. And so it takes some care, some courage, some really relying on our faith, our conviction, our confidence that we kind of step forth and do the practice. And if you're not interested in doing the Dharma practice, or you're not clear to you that Dharma practice is relevant and for what's going on, no one's here to argue that you should practice the Dharma in these circumstances. Well, I trust that you use your wisdom the best you can to know what you should do. But the Dharma is good. It said that the Dharma, sometimes it's said in English, the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. The word that the Buddha used for that good is kalyana, and which also means beautiful. The Dharma is beautiful in the beginning, the Dharma is beautiful in the middle, and Dharma practice is good at the end. I hope that you bring forth your beauty and you use this time of COVID-19 to bring forth, discover, use this time, especially if you're sheltered or on retreat in your own home and can't go out. This is a time to cultivate and develop the Dharma and support yourself. And if you can support people and help people far and near, this is a time to do it. This is a time for our wide human family to see ourselves as family all around the globe. How can we support each other? How can we help? How can we all be in this together to get through to the other side of this challenge, of this illness? And let's get through it and come to the other side and be better people because of it and create a better world to live in when we come out to the other side. So thank you for being here and listening to this. And I look forward to perhaps having an opportunity to teach the Dharma to the best that I can in some future time as well, maybe next Monday. So be well and take good care of yourself. Thank you.